طفلة تمتطيه قوس قزح، طفلة.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, where each week you will hear the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian perspective, the Palestinian voice exploring the realities of the Israeli occupation of the Palestinian homeland. You will not hear this narrative very often in the Western media, which is why it is important that it is presented each week on This Week in Palestine. We want to begin today with, again, providing some context to the horror evolving before our eyes in Gaza. By only listening to the Israeli narrative, which is reflected in our mainstream media, we are led to believe that this genocidal assault by Israel began on October 7th, with the so-called terrorist raid on Israel by Hamas. That narrative disregards the fact that Palestine has been living under military occupation for 75 years, and that Hamas's raid must be put in the context of the international right of Palestinians to resist that occupation and resist the seize of Gaza and the structured apartheid being imposed on them. So we begin today with a European voice, that of Greek political leader and diplomat Yiannis Varoufakis, who helps us understand the context for the Gaza genocide. Yiannis Varoufakis is a Greek economist and politician. Since 2018, he has been Secretary General of Democracy in Europe Movement 2025, a left-wing pan-European political party he co-founded in 2016. We hear him today in an excerpt of an interview conducted in the United Kingdom.
Before we draw this to a close, I'd like to talk for a few questions, if we may, about the crisis in Gaza that you just mentioned. The situation in Rafah is worsening. More than a million people, displaced people there now. The shelling has started. The bombardment has started. How conscious should we be in the West of the decision that came out of The Hague, that there is the potential for a genocide being caused in Gaza at this moment in time? And do you think that Israel's current actions, specifically what's happening in Rafah right now, constitute, well, I mean, you did just use the phrase, but I'd like you to expand on it, a genocide.
The genocide started in 1948. It's simply becoming more lethal, more bloodthirsty, less bearable than it ever was. The complicity of the West is mind-numbing and indisputable. Here you have an apartheid state. It is clearly an apartheid state. Anybody who's been to the West Bank knows it's an apartheid state. They've built walls and they've built roads exclusively for the use of the illegal settlers that the local population cannot use. That's apartheid. So you have an apartheid state which has always tried to merge the Zionist ideology, the Zionist narrative, with the facts on the ground. The Zionist narrative from the 1910s was a land without a people for a people without a land. In other words, terra nullius is what the British did in Australia. They said, you know, Captain Cook arrives and declares that Australia to be empty of people. So the Aborigines are not people, so kill them. Right. Genocide. It's the first step. Terra nullius is the first step towards genocide. So that's the Zionist project. A land without a people, for a people without a land. Now, of course, there were people there. There were millions of people there.
There were.
So now the IDF is in the process of ensuring that the Zionist allegory, slogan, becomes a fact on the ground. They're getting rid of them. The whole point is to expel them, to kill them, to drive them away. They do not want to kill them all. I mean, they want to kill as many as is necessary to convince the rest to leave. You can see that in the West Bank, because people say to me, but Yanis, how can you possibly support Hamas? I'm not supporting Hamas. Netanyahu supported Hamas. Likud and Netanyahu were in the business of diminishing the authority of the PLO, and they have been for decades supporting Hamas, financially, politically, militarily, until they completely destroyed the capacity of the PLO, of the Palestinian Authority, to appeal to the Palestinian people, and only Hamas is left to represent them. And in any case, let's say that we press a button and Hamas disappear. They just disappear. They're all convinced. They're brainwashed by some wonderful piece of artificial intelligence delivered by drones, to give up, to surrender. What happens in the West Bank? Hamas is not there. The ethnic cleansing, the genocide is continuing there. And of course, you can see that they just want the land, not to mention the natural gas deposits, which are off Gaza. So this is what's happening. The West, especially those who claim to care about human rights, we must accept that we have now proven beyond dispute that we never cared as countries, as polities, as establishments, as media, about human rights. We only cared about our human rights and the human rights of our friends, of our bastards. Right? If you are not one of us, you don't have human rights. You can be bombed. You're never killed. Even if we kill you, you die. Whenever they say, hang on, what's happening, they are terrorists. Right? So, never before has the West's image around the world been so terrible. What is happening is, at once, in the West, opinion, public opinion, conventional wisdom is solidifying its support for Israel's genocide, but the rest of the world is becoming more and more disillusioned with the so-called principles or ethical dimension of the Western polity, of the Western way of thinking.
You mentioned drones there, and I would like to, if we have time, to cover the intersection of sort of techno-feudalism and this conflict. But can we just hone in for a second on sort of the shifting of Israel's stated war aims? Because initially we were told it's the destruction of Hamas, right? Which poses its own questions, because does that mean the military infrastructure? Does that mean the nurses that are employed in the Hamas-run health ministry, for example? But that was the initial stated aim. And gradually the rhetoric has changed to security control in Gaza. The rhetoric is shifting. And I wonder, first of all, what you believe the actual war aim is for Israel. And secondly, whether you think that aim is achievable.
The original war aim has always been to take over the land from the river to the sea as part of a greater Israel, to expel half of the Palestinians and to keep the other half as bonded slaves. That was it. The original apartheid idea of the white supremacists, the Boers in South Africa. That's why we call it an apartheid state. That was always the case. Up until the 7th of October, that plan was working magnificently, because you and I were not even discussing Palestine, at least not to the extent that we are. Especially public opinion worldwide had accepted that it was over, that Israel had won, that the Palestinians in Gaza were fading. 60% of children before the 7th of October were malnourished, so the embargo was effectively killing them softly, slowly. And it was just a matter of time before, the people living there would want to get out. And the land would be cleared and it would be settlers and so on. While in the West Bank, you had something like 200,000 settlers 10, 15 years ago. Now you have 800, 900,000. So they keep settling. They go straight from Boston or Brooklyn or they go straight to a house of a Palestinian that has been thrown out of his home illegally in occupied land. So that was the aim On the 7th of October, Hamas's actions shook the military establishment, the intelligence establishment in Israel, because they realized that they had not contained them to the extent that they had hoped they would. But that was a magnificent opportunity for them, essentially to kill lots of Palestinians, and to use that setback in their intelligence community as an opportunity for speeding up the process of genocide. That's what it is. And as far as Netanyahu is concerned, his war aim is that the war doesn't end. An endless war, because he knows that the moment it ends, he loses the prime ministership. Mm. And you have Biden, Scholz, Macron, Rishi Sunak supporting this war criminal. They are war criminals themselves.
I'm glad you mentioned the international leaders in connection to this, because I wanted to get your thoughts on how realistic international pressure is in possibly bringing about an end to this conflict. Whether that's...
I don't see the international pressure. Where is it?
Well, that's what I'm going to ask you.
Where is it? You know, Mr. Borrell, the ridiculous supposed foreign minister of the European Union, the High Commissioner for Foreign Affairs, gave a speech for the first time which was critical of Israel. And he said that they've gone too far. They've gone too far in Gaza, right? And how can they kill these people? They are sending them the weapons, the bombs that are being dropped on Rafah as we speak. How dare he? How dare you, Mr. Borrell, ask such a question? You are arming the hands that are killing the Palestinians, and you have the audacity to question why is it that they are continuing to do it. You're giving them every reason to be doing it. You know, President Biden came the other day out and said something similar, that they've overdone it. If he orders today that the American army ceases to support through the satellite system, through delivery of armaments, spare parts for their planes, and, of course, these gigantic bombs that are being delivered daily to Israel by the American military, the war will end tomorrow.
So if it was applied, international pressure could bring about an end to this conflict?
Yesterday. It would have ended. We are, in the West, responsible for the maiming and the killing of the children of Gaza today.
That was Greek diplomat Yannis Varoufakis. And now on to our feature presentation, which today is a wonderful interview of journalist and cartoonist Joe Sacco, whose unique coverage of the occupation of Palestine is legendary. But I will leave the formal introduction of Joe Sacco to Chris Hedges, who was a friend and colleague and who conducted this interview.
Marrying rigorous and detailed reporting with illustrations that leap off the page and give his stories a texture, depth, and visceral power that is often hard to match for writers. He pioneered this work with 9 issues on the Palestinians living under Israeli occupation from 1993 to 1995. The 9 comics, later published as the book Palestine, educated a generation about the tragedy that has gripped the Palestinians since the creation of the State of Israel in 1948. Palestine, which gained a cult following, won an American Book Award, and is a staple on college syllabuses across the country. Edward Said, in the introduction to Palestine, wrote, "With the exception of 1 or 2 novelists and poets, no one has ever rendered this terrible state of affairs better than Joe Sacco." Joe's book, sadly, remains even more relevant today than when it was written. But Joe was not done. He invested over 4 years in his masterpiece, one of the finest books on the Israel-Palestine conflict, Footnotes in Gaza. He explored the little-known massacres of Palestinians by Israeli soldiers when they occupied Rafah and Khan Yunis in the Gaza Strip in November 1956. He doggedly tracked down victims and eyewitnesses to combine investigative journalism and oral history from the past to explain the present. Context is key. And context in the reporting of the genocide in Gaza is largely absent in the U.S. media. This makes Joe's work not only timely but vital for our understanding of this conflict. Joining me to discuss his two seminal works, Palestine and Footnotes in Gaza, is Joe Sacco. I've read the books before, of course. I reread them. They are stunningly powerful. I've worked with you, and I know what high standards you have as a journalist and a reporter. Palestine was really where you kind of formulated this marriage between journalism and illustration. And of course, at first, no one quite understood what you were doing or knew how to handle it. It's incredibly effective. But talk about how that evolved, how that came to be.
Okay, Chris. Well, very good to see you. I wasn't sure what I was doing, to be quite honest. I was a cartoonist doing comic books. I'd had a degree in journalism, couldn't get a journalism job. And I basically wanted to do a series of comics about sort of like a travelogue in the Palestinian territories. I was quite interested in what was going on there. And it was sort of coming out of the autobiographical tradition of underground comics or alternative comics. So I went there thinking it would just be sort of me, my experiences, talking to some people, trying to get some Palestinian perspectives on things. But when I was there, the journalistic training I had really kicked in. And I just found myself behaving like a journalist and thinking in those terms, the way I had studied. And it sort of came together organically. So in other words, I didn't have some big idea about what I was going to do before I went there. The things came together very naturally. And it's in my later work that I think I was a little more journalistically inclined. But that first work was where I was sort of experimenting with the melding of comics and journalism.
And talk about the illustration. I mean, I know because I've worked with you there. It is highly laborious. I mean, it takes you tremendous amounts of time to. I mean, we did a book together, Days of Destruction, Days of Revolt. And then I know from, of course, your great work, Footnotes in Gaza, the kind of research you do. It's not just that you're meticulous about the reporting, but you're meticulous about the images.
Yeah, that's super important. I mean, I want the reader to viscerally feel like in the places I've been, and in those times when I'm taking them back into historical episodes, I want them to feel that too. I do a lot of visual research. I look at photographs, I look at books, whatever I can get to make what I'm doing just feel more real.
And let's talk about Palestine. The book itself, it was a series of originally nine comics,
right,
put together in the book Palestine. But having just reread it, it doesn't feel like nine comics. It holds together. It coalesces as a book, partly because you look at various aspects of the occupation. Can you talk about what you did in those nine comics, and which has now been published as a book?
Yeah, originally I was going to do six comics, and it just became nine. A lot of it was episodic. I sort of let it go where it went in my actual travels. In other words, there were a lot of random events, and I think it has that quality to it. But while I was there, it became clear to me that if I wanted to sort of assemble a picture of what the occupation looked like, I would have to sort of piece together some things. So I just listened to what people were telling me. And I realized what were the important components. And then I began following them up. For example, life in prison, or what it was like to be in prison. And so many people there had been in prison that I talked to. I realized that was an essential part of it. Torture, because that was going on. The demolition of houses. And the random humiliations. So I put those things together in one section of the book, and then in another, a little more self-contained, when I went to Gaza and I talked about my experiences there. And that was another sort of part of the book where I just wanted to see how people were getting along in that incredibly impoverished strip of land.
Well, it has a sense of journey, I mean, a sense of discovery. And one of the things I like about all of your work is in that whatever journey you're on, you allow us to see exactly what is happening around you, even when it doesn't reflect particularly well on the Palestinians or even on yourself. I mean, I love your own critique of yourself as a journalist. I mean, of course, I did that job for many years. And there is a kind of darkness, maybe callousness. It's not that we don't feel. I think we do feel. But in that drive to get a story, I mean, you in footnotes in Gaza, you'll talk about those interviews where, and we're going to talk about that in a minute, the 1956 massacres in Rafah and Khan Yunis by the Israelis. But when you can't get stories about atrocities or carnage, I mean, there's a kind of frustration, or when somebody starts repeating something you've already heard before. And I mean, all of that I think that unvarnished view, including, of course, all the people who want to get shekels from you for taking you on a tour of a mosque, or all the gaggles of kids who surround you. And but we know that you're completely honest, because you don't take anything out. It reminds me very much of Orwell pushes this. But I want to just talk about the importance of that. I think it gives your work tremendous credibility.
Thank you. Well, I think it's important to show those shady parts of journalism, or sort of the seams of journalism, because when I was studying journalism, I didn't really understand how things worked in a way. I mean, I was studying it, but to me, journalists seemed like sort of demigods that were floating on the wall and looking down with their all-knowing eye. And then when you're there and you realize how you are sort of assimilating material, and you see how other journalists are assimilating it, you realize it's not quite like that. That, you know, there are a lot of misunderstandings. There's a lot of guesswork. There's a lot of realizing you don't know things, and a lot of wondering if you're being told the truth. All those things I think are important. I think they're important because I want people to understand sort of the process of journalism, the process of getting a story, and also to show that journalism is created by imperfect beings. It's not a science exactly. We all go in with our preconceived ideas, our prejudices, and you have to face those things. And I think that's just an important element of the work I do. And I'm lucky in that I'm not working through the mainstream, so I can actually put those sorts of things in it.
And also the way you will portray there, you know, you will, as you said, you will portray the seamier side of Palestine and why that's important to your work.
Oh yeah, I mean, you suggested, you're often hearing things and you realize this won't sound so great, you know, for the greater cause. But then you have to decide if you're an activist who's going to winnow those things out for some greater good, or if you're a journalist who's trying to, as much as possible, tell the story honestly. And I always went on that side of things, because I think, even when Palestinians read the work, they get it. Why should they be ashamed of all the passion and fury and anger that they might feel? It's completely understandable in the context which I am also trying to present.
You've spent many, many years, if you count the Palestine, and then we did a piece for Harper's Magazine, a diary in Khan Yunis, then you went back and did Footnotes in Gaza. What is it about Palestine, and did Palestine grip you, you know, from that first experience? But you've invested tremendous time in Palestine.
Well, I mean, you're a fellow journalist. You know, there's those particular stories that really hit you in the gut and just matter to you for whatever reasons. And I think the whole Palestine thing really mattered to me on a personal level, because I grew up thinking Palestinians were terrorists. And that began to shift around the time of the invasion of Lebanon in 81 and then the massacres in Sabra Shatila. when I realized that, oh, something else was going on. Later on, after I got my degree in journalism, I began to sort of look at how journalism had shaped that viewpoint of Palestinians. And I realized that's what it was. And I was kind of appalled by what I didn't know and what I wasn't told by journalists. You know, there was a lot of reporting of facts, like an attack on a bus, hostage situation with some airplanes or whatever it was. All of those were facts, but never any context. And I realized the only time I'd ever read or heard the word Palestinian was with the word terrorism. So in a way, I needed to do penance. I mean, I almost needed to atone in my own mind for those misunderstandings and that ignorance. And it just became sort of a special passion because, I mean, I began to see how deeply wrong the Palestinian people were historically and how badly misrepresented they were. And it's those two things, people deeply wronged and so badly misrepresented, that really pulled me in that direction.
What is it from your first trip to Palestine? And it's interesting. I was there, actually. We didn't meet then, but I was living in Cairo covering Gaza for the New York Times. What is it that particularly struck you? Was there certain incidents? What is it that first hit you or gripped you?
When I was there, it was the day-to-day humiliations and degradation. I mean, there were always things that were more spectacular. There were always, you know, you could always find stories of people who were shot, people who were wounded, house demolitions, but it was these constant stories of humiliation, men being told to get out of cars, raise their arms, and just sort of keep their arms up in the air. They seemed like little things, but they were daily and they just added up. And I realized how dehumanized the Palestinians were, you know, from the Israeli perspectives. The Israelis were constantly dehumanizing. I think over time, that's the thing that really struck with me. It's not so much the spectacular things.
Hmm. Although in all of the work, there's that constant backdrop of violence. Because in footnotes in Gaza, you will alternate between what happened in 56 and what's happening at the moment. It's on the eve of the war in Iraq. But there's that constant drumbeat. Either you hear shots and that just is pervasive through all of your work.
Well, yeah. I mean, and unfortunately, because it's been pervasive in Palestinian history. So when I was there, as you were during the first intifada, and then we were both there during the second intifada, it's like, it's not like the violence was turned on, then just turned off, and it's been off since then, and now we can all reflect on it, you know, in this way. It was constant, and it is constant. I mean, obviously, with what's going on today, you see it's ramped up to a great level. So violence has always been the backdrop for Palestinians, always, since before 1948, but in particular since 1948. It just hasn't ceased.
There's a wonderful moment at the end, I think, of Footnotes in Gaza, where you meet two Israeli women and they're saying, well, you know, you should see it from our perspective. Or is that in Palestine?
That's in Palestine.
Yeah. And you're actually go to Tel Aviv. But you have this wonderful thing of, in fact, I did see it from the Israeli perspective. I'll let you explain.
Yeah. I mean, I felt my whole life had been, I'd seen things from the Palestinian, from the Israeli perspective. That was pretty much the only perspective I had. And that's what was filtered down through all the news broadcasts I ever saw and all the newspaper accounts I ever read. So I got the Israeli perspective. And especially at that time in the early 1990s, there wasn't, you know, social media. There weren't a lot of people reporting on the ground for independent media. So I hadn't even heard many Palestinian voices. The only ones I ever heard were in sort of human rights reports. Let's say Al-Haq, the well-known Palestinian human rights organization. You know, there would be these sort of deposition-like accounts of being stopped, of being shot, or whatever it was, and they all read like legalistic. Sort of, they were very legalistic, and originally I thought I would try to draw those things. I'd see if I could get permission to draw those, and then I realized that was so dry. you know, Palestinians weren't just victims with a capital V. You know, there was many other facets of their lives. And that's kind of what I wanted to find out. I wanted to actually go and talk to Palestinians. I just, you know, you just didn't get that from the media at that time.
Well, we also reflect that, you know, I watched the settlers and I watched the IDF. So I in some sense, I do know the Israeli perspective. I just know it as it's seen through the Palestinian experience.
That's right. I mean, like the whole 2 months I spent, the major trip I took to Gaza, the footnotes in Gaza, I never once saw an Israeli soldier. I only saw Israeli vehicles, you know, armored troop carriers or bulldozers, especially, you know, military vehicles. I never saw someone's eyes. So that was also the Palestinian perspective.
Let's talk about footnotes in Gaza. This, its genesis took place in a magazine piece that we did together for Harper's Magazine. We were working in Khan Yunis, where we focused the piece, and we heard about these massacres in 1956 when the Israeli army, under the Suez Crisis, I think they were in Gaza for 100 days, if I remember, carried out wholesale killings in Khan Yunis and then, as you found out later, Rafah. And the magazine cut it out because it was history. It wasn't deemed important. You and I, of course, felt very differently, and this set you on this project. But explain what happened and why you decided to devote so many years to this book.
Well, I think it was, frankly, it was just anger that that part was cut from your piece. I mean, these seemed like very valuable memories that we were taking down, and very important in understanding the context of what was going on. I mean, you remember we met Elran Tisi, the very high Hamas official, later assassinated by the Israelis, and his uncle was killed in 1956 by Israeli forces.
He was 9 years old at the time.
Yeah, Elran Tisi was 9 years old at the time, and what he told us was, at that moment, you know, through all the grief, you know, he remembers his dad wailing and everyone, you know, incredibly upset. He said that planted hatred in their hearts. And unfortunately, there have been many instances like that that have stoked that hatred. So it seemed very important to begin to understand those sorts of historical episodes, because they're like the building blocks for what we have today. They're the building blocks of the context for what's going on now. And now is what's going on now becomes the context for what will happen in the future. So these things are important. It's important to understand them. And it's important to understand that things don't just come out of the blue. You know, this question, why do they hate us? Or the incitement comes from textbooks or something like that. I mean, come on. It comes from these episodes in history where people are shot and murdered. That's what it comes from. And now bombed.
I mean, it's fascinating. Throughout the book, the Palestinians, you're constantly being questioned as to why you're focusing on 1956 with even some anger and people hauling you off to say, well, you have to look at what they did to my house. I mean, this is more important. And I mean, you were right. But even the Palestinians themselves, often, some of them, not all of them, fail to see the importance of what you were documenting. And we should be clear that this has really not been documented. There's very little reference to this. And just to go back, when you look at the UN reports, and they do that either or, you quote the report in the book, where, well, the Palestinians say this, the Israelis say this, and of course it just nullifies the event itself.
Right. And I mean, the journalistic imperative is to say, well, this is not sort of a tennis match between two competing sides. What actually happened? And if you're not going to get it from documents and people are alive who remember it, you should make an effort to go and talk to those people. It's a very simple journalistic sort of enterprise in a way. Okay, I'll talk to people and try to find out what happened. And so that's what sort of launched me, you know, in that direction.
And explain what happened.
Yeah.
What you found out.
Okay. Okay, in there being so what you can say was a border war or a border conflict with Palestinians, mostly refugees then in the Gaza Strip. A lot of them were sort of going back into Israel to harvest their crops, to go back to their homes that they had been displaced from or expelled from. And the Israelis were obviously against this. They were killing a lot of these people. And border skirmishes started. And guerrilla groups were set up by the Egyptian army.
Which I should be clear, occupied Gaza.
Which occupied Gaza at that time. And they were running in a very sort of controlled, or they attempted to control, they were running Palestinian guerrillas into Israel. And so there were the border clashes going on that could get quite heated at times with many casualties. And in the 56 war, when basically for the various reasons, Great Britain, France, and Israel wanted to sort of lay low Egypt and Nasser, who was president of Egypt, one of the things the Israelis thought they could do is like they're doing now, is end this problem in Gaza once and for all, end the problem of the guerrillas once and for all. So when they came into Gaza and they conquered it quite quickly, they went into the town of Khan Yunis, and they didn't do a screening operation of any sort. They basically just started shooting men. They shot them in their homes. They lined them up against walls and in the street, and they shot them. And according to the UN, about 275 unarmed men were killed. Later in Rafah, a few days later, they did do a screening operation where they just had all the men gather in a school so they could screen them to see if they were either in the Egyptian military or guerrillas. In the process of that screening operation, especially when the men were running toward the school and going through the gate, they shot them or they clubbed them so badly that they died. And more than 100, like 111, 112 individuals died in that. And both those incidents had a great mark on the people, obviously. I mean, and as you say, though, some of the younger generation didn't quite understand my focus on it. But as someone told me, events are continuous. I mean, they're going on presently all the time. So it was hard for them to focus on those things. It was easier for me because that was kind of what I was determined to do.
There's a lot of violence in the book. It's a painful book to read. Many of the people you interview become emotionally very distraught. What was it like to draw it and write it?
Well, you might feel some of this, Chris. It's like when you're in the field talking to people, it's that the coldness that I sort of hint at in the book that you can get. You behave very professionally, almost like a doctor, almost like a surgeon trying to get the story in. You go in, you get the story, you come out, and you have to sort of keep your own feelings at bay. You just have to collect the information and be as accurate as possible. So that's one part of the job. The other part is when I'm drawing. I mean, even years later, that's when it sort of really hits me, because then I can no longer detach myself in the same way. I have to sort of inhabit each person as I'm drawing them. You have to sort of feel what you try to feel what they're going through in order to draw them. So that's when it becomes more difficult. That's when you're really getting the full impact of what you did. I mean, the drawing table is a harder place to be than the streets of Gaza on some level.
Well, I think you said you didn't want to go through that experience again, if I'm quoting you correctly.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know how you feel, but I always feel like that kind of journalism has sort of a half-life. There's only so much of it you can do before you begin to sort of run out of steam. So, you know, you just have to know when to maybe change focus a bit.
Well, emotionally, there's a huge emotional cost.
Right. And that's what makes it so hard to watch what's going on now.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, you feel everything that's going on now. I mean, it's pretty overpowering. I mean, you can imagine what it's like for them, obviously.
Yes, and it's, you know, in some ways it's the culmination of 75 years of indiscriminate violence, and it just seems that each time that wave of Israeli violence hits Gaza, it hits it at a level or has an intensity that it didn't have before, and what we're seeing now has an intensity we've never seen before, even in 1948. What are your thoughts on what's happening and how it is, how it should be seen from a historical perspective?
Well, as you say, it's a culmination. It might not even be the low point. That's what scares me, you know, even more. It's the natural logic of what's been coming since 1948. It is actually the logic of 1948. It's back in those days, it was the same idea. We need to expel the people. I mean, Herzl said that in the 1800s, that we need to spirit the penniless population across the border. It's nothing new in a way, but it was always inching toward this, and it seems to have reached another, what you can definitely say, a catastrophe, and what I think is looks like a genocide to me. So I don't know where it goes from here. I mean, it seems like the Israelis do want to expel the Palestinians. They just want to get rid of this population in any way possible. And I think by making Gaza uninhabitable, there'll be a lot of pressure from the Palestinians living there themselves, I think, to get out. Because a lot of them have probably reached a breaking point.
Yeah, it's clear Israel has offered them a choice. They can die from bullets, bombs, exposure, or disease. I mean, 500,000 Palestinians, according to the UN, are literally at starvation level, or they can leave. That seems to be what they're orchestrating. And it's just on a larger scale. They did the same tactic which you report on in 1948. It wasn't any different.
Right. I mean, they're just taking it to a greater level. This is kind of their big chance in a way. I mean, perhaps it'll get foiled. I don't know. But I think we've seen it now sort of at its most raw and its most naked. I mean, no one who sees it now can deny it.
I was reading that passage in your book, Footnotes in Gaza. You write about Palestinians being expelled to Gaza, and it's exactly what's happening today in southern Gaza. There's no housing, there's no infrastructure. And in the book, you're writing about how they dig holes in the ground to sleep in, which is precisely what we're seeing in Rafah and Khan Yunis at this moment.
Right. It's a complete reversion to what happened in 1948. People are in tents. People are just trying to shelter themselves. And in many ways, you know, it is worse because there seems to be a starving of the population. It's not just hunger, it's starvation. And like you say, disease and continual military assault. So it's at another point now. It's at another level.
And the other continuum, which you also note in particular in Footnotes in Gaza with the cynicism of Nasser and the Egyptians, is the indifference of the international community and even Arab countries who rhetorically will speak on behalf of the Palestinians but do very little to help them. Can you talk about that continuum?
Yeah, I think in some ways the Palestinians are a way that other Arab populations are allowed to vent their frustrations at their own dictatorships and their own conditions. You know, it's sort of the release valve for passions and anger. But I do think the average Arab person has a lot of feeling for the Palestinians. It's the governments. And I mean, governments make treaties and make agreements with other governments. They don't make them with the people. So there's always that disconnect. And yes, the Arab governments are treating this problem, mostly they're treating it quite cynically.
Have you been in touch with people you worked with? I mean, you know, I haven't been to Gaza for some time, I think since we did our magazine piece. But have you been trying to reach out to people? And if you had, what have you heard? And just talk about that connection, if there is one.
Sure. Well, I mean, there's a couple of people who I was in touch with for some time. One of them, for not so long, I haven't heard from him in about 6 or 8 weeks. I'm quite worried. Another friend, I haven't heard from him in about 3 weeks, and I'm quite worried because a lot of his family members have died. An uncle and his entire family, a cousin and his entire family, and then two daughters of another cousin and their entire families. So it's hit him quite hard. And I haven't heard from him either. So, you know, just waiting.
And how do you see it playing out? Or do you have any idea where it's headed? Or, I mean, I don't know that the Israeli government even knows where it's headed.
Yeah, it's hard to say exactly. I think Netanyahu needs to demonstrate something. He needs to demonstrate something to the Israeli people that will help him claw his way back into their hearts. And it has to be something profound, I think. And that's troubling. So I don't really expect any good things to come out of this. I think we're in for perhaps some changes, maybe some surprises. These kind of things, you lift the lid off them and you never know where they're going to go. You never know how it's really going to play out. And then you have to think, well, what's it going to look like in 5 years or 10 years or 20 years? And you just don't know. What you do know is that nothing has been resolved. The hatred will continue. The fear will continue. And if we've come to this level, what's the next step? What's the next stage?
Well, that's why footnotes in Gaza is so important.
Well, thanks. I mean, it's important to provide the context. You do wish these books would sort of run out of steam and wouldn't have the same meaning and would be, become obsolete.
It's absolutely vital. And it's just tremendous work. That was the cartoonist Joe Sacco.
Thank you so much for watching The Real News Network, where we lift up the voices, stories, and struggles that you care about most. And we need your help to keep doing this work. So please, tap your screen now, subscribe, and donate to The Real News Network. Solidarity forever.
That is it for today. Thank you for joining us this morning on This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You'll find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. Eastern Time, where you can also stream us live on your computer at wzbc.org. You can also stream us live every Monday morning at kkrn.org at 8:30 a.m. Eastern Time. Please tune in again next week for another edition of This Week in Palestine. This is your host, John Roberts, hoping you will get involved with the struggle to bring justice to the Palestinian people. We will talk again next week.